Welcome to the show that gets Christians thinking about faith and politics. Get ready to challenge the status quo, expand your imagination, and tackle controversy head on. Let's stand together at the intersection of faith and freedom. It's time for the Libertarian Christian Podcast.
Greetings. You're listening to the Libertarian Christian Podcast, a project of the Libertarian Christian Institute and a member of the Christians for Liberty Network. How can we make housing affordable again? David Rand is the president and CEO of the Land Liberty Movement, a new national nonprofit working to rebuild the American dream by restoring property rights and the freedom to build. He also produces content for Build the Dream, a Substack that explores housing policy, and you can find his work there at buildtheamericandream.org. Thanks for being here, David.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Well, so, I mean, I was excited when I heard about this because housing affordability is a really big issue for me. And I have friends, all down the political spectrum who are telling me why they think housing is less affordable than it used to be. And, some will say it's BlackRock buying up all the houses. Others are going to say, well, boomers are refusing to die or downgrade. The Trump administration is kind of basically like, blaming immigrants for it. Mm-hmm. They say we'd have a lot more housing available if we had less people here. Which I always find those arguments to be like one of those kind of slippery slope arguments. Like, oh, if we've only had less people, then okay, where are we going with that?
Right.
And so are any of these really to blame for rising housing costs, or is it actually something else entirely? Or is there maybe a little bit of this is true, but there's something else that's a bigger part of it?
Mm-hmm. Well, obviously it's multi-causal. There's lots of ways to look at this problem, and you have a big country with lots of different rules in different places. So we get some natural experimentation about what different housing policies tease out which variables, right? But when you look at the big picture, I mean, the real big picture, which is you poll all Americans, you ask them, you'll find that, it's 66% of Americans. And one of our polls said that housing is one of the biggest issues that, prevented them from building the kind of life they want. Real big abstract question like that. But then you could look further. Things like the HUD has been doing research on this for quite some time, polling Americans on gathering data about what they call rent burden. Rent burden means you spend more than 30% of your income on housing. Once you're at that level, you're kind of sitting at, it's a good chunk of your housing. That would be the historical norm back in the 1960s when they started doing that. Back then, it was about 23% of Americans. Today, it's about 50% of Americans spend more than 30% of their house on housing. That's the average. That means some Americans are spending far, far more than that, right? It's depending on income, when you get in the lower income brackets, it becomes much larger part of your housing, to the point where very low income Americans, many if you're making under $30,000 a year, which is usually the most poor, most rural areas, you have about $250 left after you've paid rent, for your food, everything else, right? So this is a huge systemic problem. Now, what sort of questions, when you're thinking of a huge systemic problem, what is the long lever answer that'll allow you to negotiate that problem for the major causes? Now, you can look at, and libertarians are great about this, looking at monetary policy. And you can see all kinds of things about asset inflation, the way that, housing becomes a booming asset during low interest rate time periods. I think there's good, Austrian business cycle theory answers to that question. But one of the other ones is one of the big stories of America in the 20th century, really, which is the counter-revolution of the managers, which is James Burnham's words for the progressive era, when we made a huge change in how we dealt with housing at one point, pre-1920s, and then after the 1920s into the 1960s, a massive growth in a centralized planning of all of our land. We used to have a property rights-based system that largely left it up to markets and free exchange in order to negotiate how prices are determined and how much supply is built. And then after the 1920s into the 1960s, we see this massive growth, first on the coasts and then kind of going everywhere after LBJ's Great Society, that blew up housing everywhere, to the point where, today, of course, we got 50% rent burden, but we're also looking at, all the way back to like 1991, this is a core cause, this is like a major issue. George Bush Sr. in 1991 put out a commission study about why is everything so expensive all of a sudden in 1991 when it comes to housing? So there's, this is a little bit bigger question than when you just look at institutional investors, which, some studies would suggest about 1% to 3% of housing is purchased by institutional investors. And there's some bad, you get these stories about whole neighborhoods being bought up by one company, and there could be some regional monopsony or monopoly problems there. But you're still looking at, that longer lever to really explain the bigger story. And zoning, various different building and land use codes, those are a much longer lever to explain the much bigger phenomena that we're talking about when you look at the crisis that we're having in housing today.
Yeah, thank you. So, you know, this is, I consider myself, I mean, as a libertarian, the more I sort of think about what, you know, what, where my kind of heart is in some of these issues, I sort of feel like I have the brain of a libertarian and the heart of a progressive, in that I care about these things. I care about housing affordability. I care about whether people, you know, can eat and, you know, can work and stuff like that. And so, but I'm just not at all persuaded that the way that we resolve these problems is some big government program, some kind of coercive, you know, systemic, you know, centralized, you know, solution. So, I mean, if you were talking to someone on the left who thinks that this is simply about greedy developers or investors, how would you just, you know, an elevator pitch, explain the housing crisis to them?
You know, we get this a lot. We get these comments on our videos a lot, which is, oh no, the poor developers making all that money. Well, the trick is, you know, and it, just like you said before, like immigrants or institutional investors or developers, these are all the, like the hobgoblins that are trotted in front of you to blame when the government's really the problem, right? And they're just getting distracted by that drama of disliking wealthy people, right? So really, you have to ask yourself as a progressive, it's like explaining the housing crisis is like explaining a plane crash with gravity. You know, the housing crisis didn't happen, you know, builders didn't suddenly become more greedy over time. They were just as greedy in 1901, right? When we had a mostly property rights-based system, and only about 23% of average Americans spent about 23% of their income on housing. Well, today it's much higher, closer to 40, 30% on average. Right? We can't explain that with greed of developers, right? That just doesn't make any sense. So maybe it's the incumbency of domestic homeowners, like people who already own property, using the government to keep people from building more housing. Now, that's an explanation that progressives can understand. And frankly, a lot of progressives are on board with this, or with this vision, even though it's a more free market, property rights-based vision. And they'll include rent control and a bunch of other stuff we disagree with. But for the most part, we've seen quite the revolution since Ezra Klein's book, Abundance, on the left about this very issue, because they're kind of realizing, hey, if you want more, you have to build more. If you want things to be affordable for low-income people, you have to make them abundant. And I think we're seeing a good revolution on that. In fact, everywhere you see, you know, good land use policy reform in the libertarian and conservative vision of that, it's almost always a coalition between far-left progressives and the most conservative people in a legislature.
It's interesting. Well, let's maybe kind of drill down into the details a little bit more. Mm-hmm. Some of the stuff, you know, if you're a libertarian, you get it a little bit. You've read some Hayek and, you know, you understand scarcity and all that kind of stuff. But how does overregulation, government planning drive scarcity when it comes to housing?
Yeah. So, I mean, a classic example that I use is just put yourself in the developer's shoes for a minute. You say you really want, you see a glut or a lot of renters, right? A lot of renters who could use more units. So you assess a territory, a given area. And you say, okay, well, where can I put in a multifamily unit? And each, there's filtering levels at each set of analysis, right? Like if 70% of your town is single family, that means 70% of that area is now just gone. It's off the market. The government has locked that into one. But even if it's not single family, you might look at a unit area that is zoned for apartments, but the minimum lot size, which is a very specific government regulation that works a little bit like single family, but isn't called that, that will actually prevent you from building in certain geometries and units. And then you'll have other ones like parking mandates, how much parking spaces, that might eliminate some things, even if you're close to public transit, or setback use requirements and building code requirements. There's so many different filtering levels that drive up the cost. And you know, you mentioned earlier that the Trump administration is largely blaming immigrants on this. And it's a little bit more complicated story than that. So they will point to that. For example, the Council on Economic Advisers recently released a report only a couple of weeks ago, maybe a month ago, I think just a couple of weeks ago, that laid out this case. I mean, it both had immigration has its variables, right? It does increase, you know, demand for housing. But if you just look at the all of the burdens that localities place on housing, you get what they call the bureaucrat tax, which increases housing costs on average. So that means some areas far less so and some areas far more so, about $100,000 per housing unit, right? And so if it comes to apartments, that's 40% of your cost to build an apartment just built in.
Just to be clear, so the bureaucrat tax is all the costs that go into building a house that have nothing to do with labor or parts. It's all about trying to make things, build things to code, to try to meet certain regulations. Mm-hmm. And you're suggesting that not all these regulations really have anything to do with safety or things that we would hope to see in housing, right?
Yeah. So safety is best usually actually organized by ordinance rather than by code, right? So you're saying all houses have to have whatever. Does that make sense? Have to have, if it's an apartment unit, it has to have sprinklers installed, right, for fires. That sort of code, you know, a lot of it just goes way out of date and does not get updated ever. Or if it gets updated, it isn't even updated by local government. There's a long story about that. But the larger picture is, yeah, you build in all of the extra compliance cost and you're looking at 40% of the cost to build your apartment per unit is just in complying with the code. And that's about 23% to 25% of your cost in building a single family home. So when you look at that in the most expensive and high demand areas, it's probably far greater because you have so many more building codes piled on from the state and local levels.
Well, and you mentioned this minimum lot size thing. And this is something that I've come across as well, that you find sometimes where zoning is such that if you want to build a house, it has to be this big a space. You can't build a very small house. You couldn't build a tiny home, for example. Mm-hmm. And I've seen that come kind of right up against different attempts to alleviate housing shortages, particularly among the homeless. And so there's an example in Los Angeles. There was a guy named Elvis Summers who created this camp of tiny homes for the homeless, and the city government shut down, you know, because I guess they thought having tent cities on the highways was a better way to do it. And there was, you know, another, you know, do-gooder I read about who had converted retail space he'd acquired into a homeless encampment before that was shut down. Mm. And so, you know, if you have an issue where you have kind of very low income people, sometimes maybe single mothers, whatever, small families, they're willing to live in smaller spaces if it's affordable. Right. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so by saying, well, no, that's not even an option. Like you can't do right. that. It becomes a sort of thing where it's like, we're going to raise the quality of the homes. They have to be this big, this many rooms, this much space. And then what you've sort of done is, like in a progressive dream, that would be, well, everybody gets this minimum level of very nice home. Mm-hmm. But what actually ends up happening is everybody who can't afford this doesn't get anything or they live in slums or whatever. Right. And so, I mean, do we need, I mean, is part of this a question of innovation that when you are trying to limit in this way, you can't have innovations like tiny homes and these little tiny home communities and things like that can make it possible for everyone to have a safe place to call home?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So minimum lot size is one of the great ones, right? Because that's really the thing that killed the starter home, especially for purchasing, right? Like where if you look at the way housing was built across, you know, prior to the 1960s, a lot of housing was built specifically to give people their first equity leverage into a home they could afford. Because back then, you didn't have nearly as many loan and like financing options as you do today. So now we have more financing options, but everything's cost much more. So it's really limited people's abilities to get access to that first house outside of like very deep and long paying financing options. When many more people in like San Francisco, for example, could afford to buy a house and then pay it off in 20 years. People are going much, much longer to pay off their house into 30, 40 years. And it's just less asset acquisition for, you know, the creation of the middle class. Now, when you look at homelessness specifically, I think when we see this issue as a housing problem, it's a little bit too monocausal. A really great book about this is San Francisco by Michael Schellenberger. I highly recommend people read it. It's very on-the-ground take. Critical of libertarians in it, so don't take it personal. But what he really means in that book is libertinism, where you can use the government, you know, public square and rent seek off that. And we did some interviews here in Bozeman from people who were, you know, man, they were working in the construction industry in Bozeman, but they're just like, I'm not going to pay $2,000 for a single bedroom here in this town. I'm just not going to do it. I will rather pay the $25 fee per month to live on the street in this camper. So there's like government externalities they've created through these systems. And then there's some other big singular causes of homelessness that I think really need to be looked at. And most people's experience of this was an explosion right around the time of like 2018, 2019 into 2021. Some of that being COVID and the insanity there. But some of that was a particular court case called Martin v. Boise, which said, you know, if you wanted to move a homeless person out of where they were living on public space, you couldn't move them unless there were a full beds, all the beds were filled in a particular given area. And so it was like, you have a right to have a housing provided for you by government. It was kind of implied in there. And that raised a lot of the risk aversion to doing anything about homelessness encampments by most localities when a district court decided that in the United States. That was overturned, but most localities have not changed their policy since then. It was overturned by a court case called Grants Pass out of Oregon. And that should completely reshape things, but many localities have just simply not changed since then because they have constituency groups and things like that that are advocating against it. So does housing costs contribute to homelessness? Absolutely. You know, it definitely does. When I talked about that $250 figure earlier, a lot of that, you know, it comes down to, you know, that economic case of when you're at the very bottom of the income ladder and something disastrous happens, you might lose your house, right? And then you end up in the street. But it's also, I mean, we all know this, it's also very multi-causal, you know, it's also drug abuse and mental health issues and all these other things. So really what we need in this space, just like with the housing space, is more entrepreneurship. You know, as much as, you know, the examples you give are, you know, maybe good projects, maybe bad projects, but we do see successful entrepreneurship in this place when they break outside of the monolithic government programs, such as, and a great one that people should look up, is called Community First out of Austin. And they've had a tremendous success rate in retaining people to keep them off of, you know, the drugs that have ruined their lives and by providing them with communities of specifically tiny homes, but they have to build them, you know, in very specific areas where you have that available land and you can get the government, it's despite the government's process, not with the government's enablement. So they have housing first policies and all these other things really create a monolithic approach when what we need are bottom up, ground up approaches that leverage community and then frankly leverage churches.
Yeah, well, maybe we should, well, I'd like to talk about the church thing because you did have a video on that I thought was really interesting. So maybe we'll go there next and I have some other questions we'll get to later. Mm-hmm. So you did talk about in one video on Build the Dream, churches that were involved in building housing, which I thought was a really interesting solution to housing availability. And it seems kind of on mission, right, for the church.
Yes.
So why are churches sometimes able to get around these challenges of building affordability that maybe developers can't? And then what are some of the other ways that they're still hitting bureaucratic brick walls?
Right. So the big barriers are that churches are oftentimes zoned with the communities that they're in. So they'll be a church in a single family zoned area, right? And they kind of like make grandfather exceptions and things like that. Depending on the locality is going to determine what your barriers are. So when the biggest initial one is usually in order to build some additional units so that you can pursue the mission of Matthew 25, which is, you know, I was a stranger and you took me in. When you're pursuing that, you sometimes have to go to the government and ask for permission to rezone so that you can build some smaller, more affordable houses. And and Virginia had a lot of this, a rash of them, like 30 cases. And one of the ones that we tell a story of is a case where they spent $500,000 and spent 5 years trying to get this area rezoned, and they still couldn't do it. And that was because, you know, as they're doing so, they're getting the neighborhood around the church showing up saying, we don't want any building here, right? It's going to bring in the wrong kind of people. And that's why property rights are so important, right? Because it demonstrates like you cannot really pursue, you know, your First Amendment religious rights unless you can embody that in some actions, right? Like it can't just be that the government says you can believe whatever you want, but it has to be on Sunday. You can't do that the rest of the week. After all that, they were able to get a law passed in Virginia, which basically said if you're a church, you can build housing, regardless of what their existing zoning was. So there's an activism level to answer your question directly, where you know getting laws passed at the state level. We had a law passed in Virginia, Florida, California. Some other ones are considering it too, I believe, that are really substantial in allowing people to on the ground make the difference. Now, this isn't a silver bullet. It's not going to solve the housing crisis altogether. But at minimum, this is a high leverage moment for the center right to think about like, do we really believe in the managerial revolution or do we believe in the much older property rights space that was our founding, that was our culture all the way up until the 1920s into the 1960s? What are we going back to? What are we trying to preserve? What element, that deductive element of prosperity as a libertarian, do you think actually generates the kind of abundance that allows people to thrive? And at least part of that is allowing people to build what they want on their own darn land, okay? And some of that's going to, and a big part of that, especially in the highest use cases, of the most risky use cases, is going to be churches to embody charity.
Yeah. Well, and to put a fine point on this, for those who are maybe unfamiliar with Burnham and the managerial revolution, there's another term for the managerial state that sometimes gets thrown around. It used to be by people on the left, and then they stopped using it when Donald Trump started using it, but it's the deep state. It's this idea that you have these people who are entrenched in the government who aren't elected, but they create this regulation, they create, anyway. And so that's a big part of it. So I'll ask kind of maybe one more technical question about the kind of the problems that are contributing to this. And then I want to hear a little bit more about solutions. So single use zoning, you've kind of referenced that a little bit so far. When did that come about and how does that directly affect a housing affordability?
Right. So single use zoning is one of the oldest forms of zoning, right? And you can find examples of single use zoning and go very, very far back. But it's basically the idea that you don't want heavy industry right next to where you have houses. The core idea being we want to take the steel mill and we're going to move outside of town. Now, even like ancient peoples had practices, right? So the tanner in your local village wasn't at the tanner, you know, town square. If you're tanning hides, it smells bad and people don't like that. So they move it. They move the tanner. They're like, hey, bro, please live outside of town, right? So this process, which used to be very bottom up and locally decided, was kind of distilled into a set of principles that then kind of got locked into laws and ordinances that failed to make a distinguishment between a steel mill and a coffee shop or a clothing store, right? Where you have areas that it might make really great economic sense to build apartment buildings above a commercial unit, and we currently prohibit that. So one of the things we investigated is it's a really great story. It's a developer in Noonan, Georgia, which the city's motto is like a city of homes or something like that, right? It's completely hypocritical. But he goes to the city council and he wants to build. He's allowed to build a certain amount of units on a given development, but he wants to build substantially more than what they're currently zoned for. And he gets shut down. And the city council says, no, we're not going to allow you to build more units because we're worried about oversupply, which really is a way to say, because we don't want to see more people move here and potential competition for rent prices.
Yeah. Which also means things become more affordable.
Right. Exactly.
And I think that this is, I mean, another part of, you know, when Trump has talked about housing affordability, he'll sort of talk out of both sides of his mouth. He'll say, well, wouldn't it be great if every, you know, people could afford housing, but those who already have houses, these, you know, boomers or whatever, who don't want their housing prices to go down, we got to protect them. It's like, well, you can't do both. You can't protect you can't use the government to protect the price of investment in these boomer houses that are, you know, $300,000 and also make housing affordable. Like that's just not the way the system works. And so,
that's a very typical objection people have, right? They're very concerned about the increase in abundance and what that's going to mean for existing incumbents. But keep in mind that you pay the cost regardless, right? If you're having any resistance here, and I don't imagine a libertarian audience have a great resistance here, but if you are or someone you know is, you know, this cost is paid by somebody. And it's often an indirect and unseen cost, right? So if you show up to that county commission or city planning meeting and object to those apartment buildings being built because you don't want to ruin the view shed or you don't want the extra traffic or whatever, those costs come into your life just circuitously, right? Through your children moving away to actually find a job or a rental place that they can afford. That's a much greater cost, isn't it? What's more important, the value of your asset in your house, or is it living close to your grandchildren, right? Everyone's paying a cost. Go ahead.
Or living in a neighborhood that's maybe not a high crime neighborhood because people can afford rent, right? I mean, there's a lot of other factors that get involved in that for sure. Yeah, so you're right. There's other costs that you pay.
Well, yeah. So I think when the Trump administration is kind of doing that, they're doing a political calculation. They're saying like, which voters or what? But the other side of that is it's a lack of confidence in our institutions, which is that, you know, people will be able to in an abundant society. You'll be able to own a home that has an appreciated cost based upon consumer demand for that home, not based upon government action. And we will still have a society where people are able to build wealth and have abundance at the same time. It's just about confidence in things being based upon the actual markets of reality. The signal actually says something about what's happening as opposed to the signal is generated by government and you have man-made scarcity.
Yeah, it's artificial.
Right.
Yeah. Well, and I don't know how many, you know, older folks who sort of treated their home as their, you know, investment, this is going to persuade. But to me, it's kind of an immoral argument. It's like, well, I was able to get in and do something for myself, but I don't want anybody else to be able to do that. Mm-hmm. And I mean, you know, if the way that someone else was doing that was to hurt you in some way, to take something from you or whatever, then I would get that argument. But what we're really talking about is getting government out of the way so that the market can work, right?
Well, this really explains a lot of the generational dynamics we look at, right? Because if you see the compounding interest effects of all of this regulation and all this planning and bad planning in some cases too, where cities are refusing to plan for the future infrastructure-wise, right? Mm-hmm. You have this atrophy of the central planning system that we have around land use. As that metastasizes over time, of course you would get generational effects where one generation has access to the American dream and the next one is looking at it like, I don't know how I'm ever going to afford a home. And that comes through in the generational statistics 100%, where you have millennials and Gen Zs looking at it like, there's just no way. And I'm not going to be able to get into a house that I really want.
Yeah, for sure.
Hey everyone, it's Doug from LCI. As you may know, the team at Podsworth Media has worked with us for a long time, producing our content for most of the Christians for Liberty network. A big part of that over the past couple of years has been using the Podsworth app to make our audio sound clean, level, and professional, even when the raw recordings were super sketchy, like this one you're listening to right now. Believe it or not, this recording was that bad before I ran it through the Podsworth app, and you can hear the full before and after demo yourself at podsworth.com. The app recently got a huge update, and it's now better than ever. So good, in fact, that it can take almost any atrocious voice recording and make it sound great. Here's how it works. It removes background noise, cuts down on plosives, fixes clipping when your gain is too high, removes clicks and pops, reduces reverb, improves tone, and levels out the dialogue so that you don't get any crazy volume jumps. Everybody hates that in a podcast. Using it is super simple. You just go to podsworth.com and click Get Started, drag and drop the audio files, open them right up from your phone's browser, customize your settings however you want. But honestly, the default works great for most settings. And here's the really cool thing. If you enter code LCI50, you'll get 50% off your first order. No account needed, just your email and payment. You'll get a download link in your inbox with cleaned up files. It's perfect for podcasts, YouTube videos, sermons, audiobooks, you name it. If your recording sounds rough, the Podsworth app can make it not only sound listenable, but professional. And remember, when you use code LCI50, you get half off your first order, and you'll also be supporting the work here at LCI.
Well, and, you know, I try to be somebody who's, you know, consistent with my positions, but I think we could make some significant progress on this issue without being, you know, kind of hardcore Rothbardians. You know, so if we want to say, yeah, the guy who's, you know, or the plant that's putting out the waste or whatever, maybe we don't put that in a residential zone. But that makes sense. We can understand that. Maybe we do have some regulations related to safety that are like legitimately related to safety, that you're not building houses where, you know, the second floor is caving in or whatever, you're falling on someone else's house. Yeah. But those are like, I think we can be sort of pragmatic about it. But one thing I would like to think that we could agree on if we were having these sort of conversations more from the right, the left, and libertarians, is that we have done this in such a way that it's so expensive that it's really does nothing of significant benefit. And those things need to be stripped away. If we still want to be able to, you know, if we still want to say, you know, put the tanner outside of town or whatever, that seems reasonable. I could understand that. But there's so much that we could really do that's, I think, very pragmatic and just makes sense, right?
Yeah. So if you wanted to get there, right, for the libertarian audience, I mean, Hayek's constitutional liberty has a pathway here, which is that we have an inherited set of institutions that are based upon evolutionary processes that say that cultural evolution here that says, hey, look, we've arrived at something as the West. And it's something that looks like English common law. That common law has a very specific provision, what we call summarized as nuisance law. Meaning, if you're imposing a cost on me, I have a right to sue in a civil court in order to get compensation for that nuisance that you're providing. Once you have a set of nuisance law cases built up and you say, oh, here's a standard that we've arrived at bottom up through a jury and a judicial process, you can embody that in an ordinance. But that ordinance, structured correctly for liberty, should be narrowly constrained to what actually imposes real harms, right? So we're going to say you can't have a manufacturing that imposes this decibel amount of noise on your neighbors at certain times of day. Then you're looking at, well, is the data center qualifier from that? What's the design of the data center? Oh, well, is this 3D printing manufacturing area? Does it control the right kind of external pollutants for the people near them? You would discover those things and then create ordinances that are neutral to that. And you would do that on the local level. That would be the responsibility of local government to embody those things in a neutral law. So you can reduce the friction cost and then plan out ahead of time and know what your rules are before going in. But our current process is to empower a set of experts to forecast the future and pretend like they have any of the knowledge required to know exactly what these things should be or what they should look like. And rather than a discovered law, we're going with an imposed centrally planned law. So why not go, and it's obviously the first system's not working and the right people are not empowered to make the decisions. They're going to make the decisions on the benefit of the incumbents, not based upon all the available information that are embodied in the builders and the new demanders, AKA the new generation. So how do you get there? Well, you empower the builders and you empower the new generation to find the to find the supply where it can meet demand.
Yeah, well, and you know, when you talk about the nuisance laws, I remember reading, you know, Rothbard's For a New Liberty and how we discussed this issue. And there are two kind of planks, and this might not satisfy some folks who are maybe more progressive, but I thought they were interesting. And one was that, you know, if somebody wants to live near a factory because it's cheaper, because no one else wants to live there, they can make that decision and they can sort of come out ahead a little bit, right? So they have the pollution or, you know, the horrible sounds all day long or whatever, but they go, yeah, but I have cheaper rent. But the other thing that Rothbard mentions is, you know, that nuisance kind of, you know, I guess you call it like a tort, the sort of what happens between people. And so if you want to build a factory in a residential area or, you know, you could built into that, there's costs that are being imposed on you to sort of make it up to your neighbors, which I also thought was kind of interesting that, you know, if you're somebody who doesn't make a lot of money, you know, you buy a cheap house near a factory and then you also get paid by the factory because they're polluting.
Right.
Like I said, progressives might not like that, but I you know, as somebody who has to watch his pennies in his budget, I could think, I might consider something like that.
Yeah, sure. I mean, and it beats living in the street, right? I mean, it's better to live in a house near a factory. But, you know, and this is, ultimately, there's a lot of fruit to pick that's much lower, right? That is just that you can get much further on things that just take residential land, allow you to build more property on an already existing residential land. Like that's a simple common sense solution that most people can board with. We could build coalitions around.
Yeah, I like that. Well, let's talk a little bit more about Build the Dream, which is your Substack for addressing the housing shortage crisis. And maybe we can get a little biographical here too. Why did you start it? We'll start with that.
Yeah, so I was involved in the Montana Miracle, which was dubbed so by Reason Magazine and others to say Montana had a huge housing crisis, a huge demand spike, thanks to Yellowstone and COVID-19 and all the other stuff that was going on in that era. We had already been experiencing a lot of distress in new demand of people moving into the state, you know, cheaper airfare and things like that, more internet were allowing people to come to Montana and remote work. So I was involved in a range of policy reforms that took a red state, which Montana was purple, has become far more red and consistently red, and moved us far beyond anywhere else in terms of just radical change to land use policy to say, hey, you own it. This is your land. You want to build that ADU, you can. And we, you know, obviously it was the legislative process, so there was compromises and we made marginal gains in some areas and radical gains in others. But it really was with a tremendous amount of leadership and effort, we were able to move the ball substantially. So I got interested in the land use issue from there, right? It was solving a real social problem with the philosophy of life, with the philosophy that we are given to us by our birthright, our ancestors, and, you know, by, you know, this common sense of economics of just like, hey, we have supply demand problems. How do we fix them? So once that happened, I got interested in the issue. Go ahead.
Just kind of thinking, you know, what's sort of the metric? How were you able to say we solved the problem? What were the numbers looking like that before and after?
Well, it's confidence in our systems, right? So the confidence that I have is that when you empower regular people to solve the problem, that's a longer lever. You're not going to be able to just, okay. So if, for example, we passed a law that said all rent is now cut by 20%, are you solving the problem or are you reallocating the cost in a new area? You're going to pay other challenges by doing that. So you don't have the immediacy of that. But what we did is we said, what is the thing that's missing? Well, it's property rights. So we re-enabled property rights radically. And obviously that became a big stir. It was like, wow, this right-wing state is moving in this way. What does that mean for the future? And we've seen other states follow us in that. So we took another stab at it in 2025. And in that process, I kind of realized after I connected with some other national housing groups of the kind of the moderates to the left to other groups that are doing it on the right, like Mercatus and Cato and all these other groups, you know, I met with them at, you know, conferences and we were talking about it and there wasn't really a center right housing brand that could really try to take these things and embody them for Republicans and conservatives and libertarians all over the country to kind of wrap our minds around this issue set and advocate for a solution that leaned into our philosophy of like what actually solves the problem, as opposed to like a temporary patch, like rent control or inclusionary zoning or something like that, that only reallocates costs. How do we fix the fundamental? And, you know, our role is to make that case, right? Is to try to bring the right into the reconciliation of like this. If you're going to solve a problem, this is one of the big problems to solve that will actually help us add to our number and recruit more people into the philosophies that we have that actually solve real social problems, as opposed to just moving costs around and trying to manage things with government.
Yeah, well, and there's something there, I think, about individual rights that, you know, the right and the left approach these things differently, but at their core, I think they do care about individual rights and they care about things like affordability. And so it can be very bipartisan mm-hmm. in that way. But I guess specifically with the Montana miracle, was it just that there was a shift in policy or was there actually a notable shift in like affordability that could be sort of measured?
Yeah, we've seen some amounts of those measurements. Like, for example, we have a tremendous amount of construction going on. But okay. Keep in mind, even with all the reforms that we made, there's still a lot left on the table, right? We still have a long ways to go. And if you talk to legislators in Montana, they still have a lot more they want to bite at. But, you know, you have localities who are still, you know, need to go through being sued. Whitefish, Montana, for example, right now is going through a lawsuit because someone wants to build a 3-story apartment. Mm-hmm. You know, like there's some radical thing. So there's a lot, and then we just recently, every time we pass something, there's a lawsuit from some group trying gotcha. To make it stop by Montana court. So we've had the delayed price success, but we also have increasing demand, even as all these other things are happening. So it's hard yeah. to know what, at any given time, what you're doing, but we think we're in the right direction. And when you look at like the best control cases, and if you, the strongest control case we have is Houston. Right. So Houston is the most affordable major metro in the United States, about 27% cheaper than every other major metro. And that's because they never had zoning in the first place. They never implemented it. From the 1920s to the 1960s, when zoning really blew up across the country, when LBJ put that into the Great Society, Houston said, no, thanks. We don't want that. We're going to turn down the HUD dollars. We're never going to body that. We have our own way of doing things here. And we think that, you know, based upon Houston, based upon when you look at it internationally, there is so much that there's such a long time horizon to really get this supply and demand thing to work that if you head in this direction, it will work eventually, especially when you have other variables, right? Your turn on immigration could be a variable, but also your monetary policy could be a variable. Like if you're inflating the money supply too much, it might not matter what you're doing with property rights to change housing, but you're going to get the most close to an actual market signal when you have property rights rather than central planning.
Yeah, which I guess is why it would be interesting to have a city like Houston where a lot of those variables are the same consistently across the country, right? Like inflation or whatever. Mm-hmm. But you see this one difference and then you can sort of measure what's happening because of that one difference. Right. Are there other places in the United States where you think housing policy is being done right or righter?
Yeah. So Texas is making a lot of great moves. Florida just recently passed a whole nother set of zoning reforms. You know, New Hampshire has some great stuff when it comes to doing commerce in your own backyard, at your house. There's so much happening in this space right now. We really need to work on like a policy primer to get people a sense of it. Because we're talking thousands of bills across all state legislatures right now, moving on zoning. So Mercatus is doing some really great work to try to document them all and pull them all together. And you should check them out for that. Yeah.
It's great. Well, so we've talked a little bit about, you know, those who are opposed to some of these changes and why. And, you know, sometimes it's older homeowners who don't want to see the price of their home go down because they're kind of counting on it for their retirement or whatever. Mm-hmm. You know, thinking in terms of, you know, sure, we both know who Thomas Sowell is and that idea of trade-offs, right? Mm-hmm. That every solution is going to have some winners and some losers, and that's not something we can deny, you know, but we are going to say that overall, this is the best solution. Freedom is going to be the better solution overall. Yeah. But who would you say potentially loses under your preferred reforms, and how would you convince them that the trade-offs are worth it overall?
Sure. So your planning class are the only objective losers, I think, right? Because even your, you know, your boomer who fought their way up into the middle class and is currently relying on that reverse mortgage to retire, they have far more to give to the following to their following generations by these kinds of reforms. Because I actually don't really believe we're going to see their housing prices go down. We're just going to see them not grow as fast. And that's okay. Like, that's a sacrifice we should be willing to make for the next generation. I know I would for my children. So the question is like, what are the things that we're willing to pay for? And are we willing to pay for a planning class to tell everybody everywhere exactly how they should use their land? I just don't think so. And I think if we lean into the American tradition, the American birthright, we will have a far better, not only outcomes in the shorthand when it comes to the economics, but also a better society when it comes to being able to serve our neighbor at our churches, or in order to, you know, if you're retiring and you want to retire close to your grandkids, building an ADU so that you can live with your kids. What's wrong with that? And I fail to see how that system doesn't empower the people who are at the end of their life as opposed to only hurt them. It's only looking at one side of the ledger.
Well, it does seem to me, you know, there's an assumption there that boomers are, you know, have children and grandchildren or care about the future generation. So presumably if you're a boomer that hates the future generations, you hate your kids or your grandkids, then maybe you would be a loser in this scenario. It wouldn't really benefit you in the long run.
Yeah, I just think those are the exceptions, not the rule. I know they have their stereotypes and you know, my parents are boomers and they are not that way, but, and I've never met one. I'm sure they exist and those people are out there. But ultimately what we want to make is public policy based upon who decides. And who should decide this is the property owner, who is able to actually make the calculus on the benefit of themselves and the consumers. And then we can see, and especially for the more communitarian conservative crowd that is very concerned about the local control here. And I know there's some parts of libertarianism that's also kind of leans in that direction where we don't want the state telling localities what to do. But imagine this, what really embodies the evolution of a given neighborhood or area? Is it the planning commission, five people on the planning commission deciding exactly what a community should look like through public feedback and who shows up at the community meeting? Or is that best navigated by the individual commerce decisions of the people who live there, right? Which is the actual embodiment of the will of everyday people in an area? Prices or political decisions? I think prices are a far more, and if you look at Alexis de Tocqueville and the way he described America, it wasn't that, oh, the government's so great about planning for the future. It was about how communities solve for themselves, not using government through subsidiarity, through, you know, a tiered approach that said, hey, if families can't solve it, then maybe communities and churches can solve it. And if communities and churches can't solve it, maybe the government should solve that. And just only those things, right? That tiered system would work far better to handle the oncoming challenges that we have of AI to immigration to all these other things are better solved when they're solved locally by the people who actually have like some skin in the game.
So I like the localism thing, but I'm going to ask you an anti-local kind of question now, which is if you, let's say you were the director of HUD or the president or whatever, and you had the power to implement just one housing reform. And now, of course, presumably we're talking about having the government step back, but it's still kind of a solution from the top. So just one reform that you could implement tomorrow that would meaningfully increase housing supply and or decrease cost, what would it be and why?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, and political actors have many things to calculate simultaneously. Always difficult to come up with a single bullet solution. But I'm not gonna dodge the question. I'm gonna answer this question. It would be ADUs, accessory dwelling units. If you have a garage and you want to turn it into something else, I don't see why you can't. Right? If you want to put that tiny home onto your property so you can rent it out on Airbnb and make some extra money, I don't see why you can't, or do long-term rentals, or house your grandparents or your children. We have some great stuff coming out about ADUs. I'm really excited for, but to give a teaser on it, a guy moved into a valley in the 1960s and built a life there. Orchard, has a like great little family there. Family all grew up and moved out. It's a split level, and he's in his 80s, so he's got a bunch of stairs, and he don't want to navigate stairs. He fell down the stairs. His wife fell down the stairs. They're having medical issues because of it. And he wanted to keep it in the family, you know, and this is a rural place. So he wanted to sell his place, submarket value, to one of his grandchildren and then build an ADU for him and his wife to live on so they could stay close to their orchard, stay close to their grandkids, and keep it in the family. That was not going to happen because the counties were saying no to ADUs, right? So like these sorts of things are real life challenges that real people face in trying to plan their lives that just go unseen by the discourse that says, well, we have to have someone decide. We can't let regular people decide what to do with their property. So ADUs are one of the things that I think, and it has less it has more redevelopment potential than other sorts of things do. For example, it's harder to knock down a single family home and put a duplex on it, right? As opposed to building a second unit where a multifamily or a single family already exists. And we've zoned so much of American cities, like 60, 70% of many American cities are single family zoning. So just allowing ADUs there would provide so much more flexibility to a single thing. But you have other challenges, right? So even if you get ADUs, but they have minimum lot sizes, you might be out of luck. So it's hard not to compare it with at least a couple other reforms to really get the advantages we want.
Well, but I think, you know, one reason why the ADU thing is might be a good thing to focus on is because it's, I mean, that's one of those things that I think that's kind of patently absurd that you can't do that. Right. Mm-hmm. And I think like most people could sort of, whether you're left, right, you know, center, libertarian, anarchist, whatever, you're going to go, well, that's stupid. Why is that? Why is that? That doesn't seem to keep anybody safe. Or, right. Mm-hmm. Well, so let's say, you know, pretty much all of your reform ideas were adopted across the board in America. What do you think the country would look like in about 20 years?
Yeah. So rural America would be able to put a trailer on that property or a prefab of some kind and save $10,000 to $20,000. Right off the bat. So cheaper financing just by not having singular federal rules like the chassis mandate that impose those kind of barriers on rural America. For your renters, that means you have more competition for all those landlords. And more competition for landlords means less crazy landlord stories about the landlord never calls you back, nothing's ever repaired. Well, there's going to be competition in that space. Less rent control. So you have landlords who have an economic incentive to update and maintain their buildings because they're not made unprofitable by rent control. You have localities who are building more single family, small units that allow for more entry into that townhome, condo, kind of that missing middle between large single family and apartment buildings that really kind of can work as most people's entry point in cities into the middle class. So that means more wealth built for the next generation, more employment through, you know, construction, that allows people to, you know, build and more innovation in the construction space. We have some awesome stuff happening in prefabs, but are largely limited by the building codes that make it so you have, you know, a million different jurisdictions in order to comply to build one thing in one area. It doesn't allow you to do it from the other. So if we get the big enchilada here, we get property rights and you can build what you want as long as it's within safety ordinances that are content neutral, that aren't telling you exactly what to build, but just what you can't do to impose costs on your neighbors. It would be a much better society where people are able to pass something along, live close to their grandkids, live close to their larger families, and really build community where cities evolve naturally. There's a great book called The Death and Life of American Cities, where it describes how cities themselves are an organic set of relationships that, you know, they have shops and apartments over shops and the, you know, you go to the corner market and that thing is responding to consumer demand and they're not centrally planned or imposed. That allow people to really build something as a community over time. And we've short-circuited that. We've made it instead, you know, so zoned off and quarantined off that it's made it so that you don't have any of the incentives to provide for a locality. Instead, everything is about these really large efforts and projects as opposed to the marginal gain that really is what defines community character. Whether you're talking about a small town, rural area, the exurbs, the suburbs, or urban areas, each of those has its own, you know, like embodiment of values it wants to express, but that are actually suppressed by the zoning code and by these building practices.
Hmm. Well, so you know, we talked a little bit about trying to make this case with those on the left, and you've also talked about ways in which there might be some disconnect with conservatives. But you've argued that property rights really ought to be a winning idea with conservatives. That's something that conservatives traditionally liked, wanted to conserve. But the practical reality is that conservatives are often resistant to a free market and housing. Why do you think the disconnect is there? And I asked you earlier, how would you talk to someone on the left? How would you reach someone on the right on this kind of issue?
Yeah, you know, it depends on the person, of course. Like if they're approaching this philosophically, right, it would be that, what are we trying to maintain? Are we trying to maintain the progressive revolution, right? Or are we trying to maintain the vision of the founders? Our ancestral birthright of property rights that makes us unique. I mean, it's a human universal property rights in many ways, right? They rediscover it in Maoist China, for example, bottom up through rebelling against the agricultural planning board, right? You rediscover it in USSR. You rediscover it across many places on earth, but uniquely in the West, we put it into the Magna Carta. We did wars over this thing with like the levelers and the Great Revolution, all these. We said that one of the things that makes us different is we empower the individual with the right to determine their future. And part of that being the property right and making that as close to our list of other rights that we hold dear, First Amendment rights and Second Amendment rights. If we do that, if the conservative movement can embody that, we will have a much more compelling case for the future. And so there will be a conservative movement in the future if we do that. If we fail to do that, then they're going to turn Bernie Sanders on us, right? They're going to go the other direction. They're going to find the person who's actually trying to sell them a solution that they can grab onto. So would we rather sell the solution that anchors into our own way of seeing the world? Or are we just going to say, tough luck, kid. Wait long enough and maybe you'll get the access to that you've been promised, but denied your entire life. I just don't see that as a compelling case. We have to have an activism movement in the conservative movement that is casting forward solutions based upon the principles of the past. So that's my conservative case, right? Is that we have to maintain something of substance that goes to our roots, that our real roots, that really makes us America and not some other place. And there's a practical case, which is that if the Republican Party does not address, you know, real affordability issues with practical solutions that make sense on the ground about who decides, they're not going to win elections. That's just the reality. I mean, affordability is the apex predator of all political issues right now. And it's only getting worse.
Yeah. Well, and you know, unfortunately, the Republican and Democratic parties have decided that the way that they win votes is to focus only on culture war issues and rather than these issues of freedom and things that, I mean, really touch us in our day-to-day lives. You know, those of us who actually touch grass and don't just spend life on, you know, Twitter or whatever, we care about these issues. We care about inflation. We care about housing affordability. We care about the cost of groceries. And I don't see anybody in the right and left really meaningfully addressing that. And so this is one of those issues that I think really could be a winning issue.
Right. And it's something that's practical on the state level, meaning like you don't have to wait to reform the Federal Reserve System.
Right.
Like that's a much harder target. We can get much more radical reforms with smaller bills passed at the state level. And we can have similar to the marijuana revolution where all these states just said, no, we're going to do this other thing, even though it's still scheduled, whatever. We can do the same thing on housing and force the federal government to recognize property rights. And then we can get marginal gains on the federal level too. We got the Road to Housing Act, things like that. But it's unlikely right now, despite my will to, you know, end the Fed, many other people are not on board with us yet on the conservative movement, much less the progressive side. But we do have this opportunity right now in housing. So why not? Why not lean into it? Take the political risk to solve the problem for the coming generation who really does is starting to vote more and more now and is making up major parts of the coalition. If you want to win, you got to go this way. Another one. Parties that are out of power tend to care about real issues, right? So the Democrats, they're focused on affordability right now in a major way. It's a major threat to the future of the Republican Party if they don't. So they have to make the hard pivot in that direction. Or we're going to see a very different makeup for Congress and everything else. I mean, it's already going to be rough, but it's going to be far rougher if we get more of a Mamdani Democrat Party.
Right, which I think is what's going to happen if this younger generation coming up is convinced that the solution is to eat the rich, this problem gets worse rather than better. Yeah, and as you said, this is an issue that you can deal with not just in the federal government, but the state government, but also the local government. And you could run for city council on this kind of a platform and I think really connect with people and get them excited about, you know, the cost of housing being more affordable. Build the Dream is a Substack. I think that's where I want to send people for sure. Mm-hmm. Buildtheamericandream.org. Where are some other places that people should look for the stuff that you're doing and where can they, I kind of get behind some of the stuff and try to actually make something happen.
100%. I really appreciate it. Yeah. So buildtheamericandream.org is our main outlet. That's where we're building. We're a small nonprofit. It's just me over here. And I got some contractors helping me out, making it look good and sound good. But other than that, yeah, I need financial support. Anyone who can get on there and sign up for, you know, a not tax deductible, but you can give me some cash to keep me producing stuff and help me pay my producer. And then you can go to landlibertymovement.org if you want to make a tax-deductible donation. That's a great way to support what we're doing, especially if you want to get that sweet, sweet tax cutoff for 501c3s to reduce your taxable liability. That would be very much appreciated. But if you like our content, specifically in the video space, we are on Spotify, X, you know, YouTube, all the different places you can check us out. We have shorts that go out on Instagram, on TikTok, and on Facebook. So we're trying to get out to build as broad an audience as possible. So we try to make content that if you're a libertarian and you're into this stuff and you got people who aren't, you know, super nerdy like you on these issues. You know, I make stuff that hopefully you can send them to try to build the policy majority here, to build the popular will for these solutions so that we can get things changed.
And like we said, it connects with people on the left. It connects with people on the right for sometimes different reasons, but sometimes the same reasons. So that's great. So money is somewhat of a concern. You haven't been made a billionaire by the Koch brothers or Heritage Foundation throwing money at you.
No, we don't have any of those sorts of connections. We are applying for grants. We have a small grant that was part of like let me get off the ground and actually get things started with like the kind of quality we've been able to build the dream so far, despite being very new. But that is not going to last forever. I've got a small runway here to try to raise enough money to keep this thing going. So I'd really appreciate any support.
Awesome. David Rand and buildtheamericandream.org and the Land Liberty Movement.
Yeah.
Great. Yeah. Perfect. Okay. Awesome. And I'll make sure we have links to all that stuff in the show notes for those who want to check it out. And I hope you do. And this is one of these great issues that you can be talking about with friends on the right and on the left. And I think really change some minds and make a big difference. So that's great. Thank you so much, David, for your time.
Thank you, Cody.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the Libertarian Christian Podcast. If you like today's episode, we encourage you to rate us on Apple Podcasts to help expand our audience. If you want to reach out to us, email us at podcast@libertarianchristians.com. You can also reach us at LCI Official on Twitter. And of course, we are on Facebook and have an active group you are welcome to join. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
The Libertarian Christian Podcast is a project of the Libertarian Christian Institute, a registered 501c3 nonprofit. If you'd like to find out more about LCI, visit us on the web at libertarianchristians.com. The voiceovers are by Matt Bellis and Catherine Williams. As of episode 115, our audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.